I really had no idea where this was going. Like, are they really building cases? Until one day in the fall of 2009, Friday morning, my wife just had our first child. She's at home on maternity leave. We're up at 6 a.m. FBI says, turn on the TV, turn on CNBC. There's 20 guys in handcuffs. All these names are on the screen, people I recognize. There's one name, Dan, that was not released. And they were calling this person like right in the middle of all this, Tipper X. And I called the FBI to make sure. Am I Tipper X? He's like, yeah, that's you.
Hey everyone, welcome to How Success Happens. I'm Dan Bova, writer and editor at Entrepreneur.com. And today we've got something a little bit different from the norm. We talk so much about the kind of inspirational side of striving for success, but today's guest is going to talk about the darker side of that chase, where it can lead, and what to do if, in his words, you completely blow up your life. Tom Hardin is our guest today. He's the author of the new book, Wired on Wall Street. I've got an advanced copy right here, which tells his personal story of becoming Tipper X, an FBI informant in the largest insider trading investigation of this generation. Welcome, Tom.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me on.
And yes, it should be noted for the record, we are both wired right now.
That's right. No longer me for the FBI, though. Thank you.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank goodness.
Well, Tom, this is a wild, wild story. It reads like, you know, just for people who want to read like a edge of your seat book, it's great for that. It's great talking about the ethical side of things, just everything about it. I really, really love this book. And the scary part for me personally is that it's not like you, Tom, you were like set out to become some super villain and I'm going to rob a bank and I'm going to become the richest man in the world. It's as you describe, you're working at a hedge fund and there's these shortcuts and there's this little slippery slope, but that's a bad. And then it sort of comes into something bigger.
Yeah, no, that's right. I grew up in Georgia, middle class family, first of my family to leave the South to attend college at UPenn-Wharton. So was a great student and got into the hedge fund world. We're talking nearly 2000s, around the time of the tech stock bubble. And Dan, in the first few years of my career, I became aware that insider trading was rampantly happening in my hedge fund industry. It was sort of an open secret where funds would hire analysts to work for them to pick stocks, and those analysts were hired from public companies in Silicon Valley. So they would call back to their old contacts, get this information. I never felt I had to cross that line. I was always considered a good investor. I really like looking at companies. Long and short is interesting in tech stocks because that means you can bet on the new company, and short or bet against the old company. So, as I wrote in the book, one idea I had that I never saw come fully to fruition was about a year after the Google IPO to be long Google and to be short the Yellow Pages. And younger listeners will not know what the Yellow Pages are, but Daniel and I know these were. So look it up on Wikipedia, I'm sure.
You're working at a hedge fund, and I believe, as you wrote, you're doing well. What sort of got you onto this slope that you talk about?
So at 28, 29 years old, I'm a junior partner at a hedge fund. The final place I worked, we were investing with a 3-year horizon, sort of these ideas of long Google, bet against Yellow Pages. But we lost money in the first quarter of my second fund, which really shouldn't have mattered because we were investing longer term. My boss walks into my office, closes the door, and says, "Hey, we just lost money in the first quarter. We have to start looking for shorter term opportunities that make money every month, or we may not survive." And when any goal in any business goes from 3 years to now the scoreboard resets every 30 days, the opportunity to start looking for corners to cut certainly increases. And I'd also say, Dan, it was a very ambiguous message. Do what it takes. He knows what everybody else is doing. Me, as the young analyst, I didn't ask any clarifying questions of my boss, who was my mentor. Hey, are we talking about what everybody else is doing, or are we going to stay within the legal or ethical guardrail? So I always encourage people today in my talks to ask those clarifying questions. Just don't make assumptions and get lost in this sort of ambiguity of what do we mean here.
Now, when you start to get into this line of thinking, do you I mean, Wall Street, the movie Wall Street was out by that point. Do you start to feel like Charlie Sheen in this scenario? What's happening?
A little bit. So just a few months after that meeting, I received a tip from another investor who I knew had worked for this billionaire, Roger Ottenham. I mentioned in the book, he's probably the most famous person later to be charged in these cases. She says, "Hey, everybody's doing this." Gives me a tip on a private equity company who's going to buy a public company in a few weeks. Here's the date, here's the price, here's the private equity firm. So when I speak at colleges, I say, "Hey, students, imagine, the answers to the test just fell in your lap. Are you going to look at them, or just throw them away?" And I didn't make any trades, but I shared it with a friend who was losing money that month. I said, "Hey, I have something for you that'll help you." Just right there, so people know I've now violated insider trading laws just by sharing this information, and I haven't traded yet. He tells his whole firm. He calls me back. "Dude, did you buy some?" And then I hate to say it, but I was sort of having FOMO, like this guy's going to make millions. So I gave the information to the woman that called me is going to make millions. And I'm just going to sit here and watch this. And when somebody crosses a line, there's something called a fraud triangle. There's a need to cross a line. So we had this need for short-term performance. There's an opportunity. So at my firm, I could buy a stock in the portfolio and not have to talk to my boss as long as it was less than 1% of the funds that we manage, so a very small position. So I remember calculating and buying a 0.9% position in the portfolio in this stock. And the third element of the fraud triangle is rationalization. So I can tell you every rationalization I use, these other guys are doing it. Who am I hurting? This is victimless. I'm just buying it before everybody else. I'll do it just this one time. So very poor self-talk, in that situation, at that moment in time.
Yeah, and as you write, because it wasn't like you were doing this for decades. This is sort of a relatively short period of time, but you wrote about a moment where you realized, okay, maybe this is a little sketchier than I realize, and that has to do with a bundle of cash. Can you talk a little bit about that?
That's right. So this is where it escalates. So the deal happens, as she says, the stock's up 30%. I thought, oh my gosh, is my boss going to fire me? He's going to see this trade. He basically looks the other way. The term is willfully blind. So he says, "Hey, don't tell me how you're doing this, but keep doing it." And then she calls me and says the guy that tipped her wants $15,000 in cash, or excuse me, $10,000 in cash. Can I write this guy a check? And I thought, what the? You can imagine what I said. What the heck are you thinking? That's illegal. I rationalized the trade. That doesn't sound so bad to me. But actually, writing a guy a freaking check, I won't do that. But I called my friend who I tipped and said, "Hey, here's the situation. If we're going to get more of these ideas, we have to pay this source." He gives me the cash, and this guy's going to be in New York. I'm leaving my office on 40th Street in Manhattan, Park Avenue. This guy on the corner says, "Are you Tom?" I don't even look at him then. I just hold the envelope up. It could have been anybody in Manhattan. But I remember at that point feeling very disgusted with myself. And what would my grandmother say? I mentioned in the book, Grandma Harden was a big sort of character who helped pay for my college education. Like, that's a good test. If you're going to make this decision, what would Grandma say? She would not have been happy. So,
Oh man. Jeez. Now, you write about this in the book, and I've heard you talk about this in interviews where, the obvious thing that most people would think that's bleeding you on is like, hey, who doesn't want to make more money? But for you, it wasn't quite about that. It was more about being on the inside of something. Can you talk a little bit about that?
yeah, I had this fear of not, as you mentioned, in my 20s, I was very insecure about not being part of the illicit in-group. Always felt I was on the outside of people who was getting this information. And this goes all the way back to college, as I wrote, "I'm Tom from Georgia at this Ivy League school. I don't fit in." And it kind of went through my career. And on the four trades, in my talks today, I say, "Ladies and gentlemen, what do you think I personally made?" And people start shouting, "Oh, millions of dollars." And then right there on the screen, $46,000, which I say is the price of professional suicide. And people always think, well, the bad guy must have made millions. Like, why would you do it otherwise? And that's not really the case. It's often these rationalizations, being lost in the group, making yourself feel like you're not doing as bad as the other person. And I never thought about the money I made on these trades. It was more about, now that I had the information, now I very foolishly thought I have status. Now I'm part of this in group who seems to have status in the industry.
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone can relate on some level to that for sure. Can you talk about the other time when the time when someone said your name and invited you to upstairs at a Wendy's? Can you tell us
That's right.
about that
I'll
moment?
never forget that. So I want to say it was about 9 months after the fourth and final trade, where it's kind of out of sight, out of mind, because it's now 2008 financial crisis. People remember that time. It was just crazy. The stock market was getting crushed. These banks were going under. And I'm just trying to survive at work. Now it's July of 2008, 6:30 in the morning. I'm leaving my apartment in Manhattan to drop off some dry cleaning. And somebody behind me on the Manhattan sidewalk says, "Are you Thomas Covey Harden?" And Dan, the last time I heard my full name was my mother back in Georgia, and it wasn't her. She wasn't in Manhattan. I turned around, and just everybody's seen, this scene in a movie or a TV show. FBI come sit down with us, two agents, male and female, dark suits. That wallet, flips open. And everybody sort of always asked me, "Why did you sit down at a Wendy's?" It just happened to be a Wendy's next to my dry cleaner, so it wasn't like we were looking for a Wendy's. And we went upstairs at this Wendy's, and he said, "Hey man, we know about your four trades. We know that you were just down in Georgia visiting your baby nephew." And then they knew his name, and I was just there 2 days before. And my
Wow.
first thought was, "Oh my God, my parents are going to kill me!" Right? They only could talk about my success. Just they don't know what a hedge
Right.
fund is. I'm just doing well. Oh my gosh, my
Yeah.
wife's going to leave. We just got married. Oh my God, I might be going to prison. But that was my line of
Right.
thought right there. Worst day of my life in that moment with the FBI and the Wendy's.
Wow. So what did they say to you? I know, well, I read the book, so I don't want to give away too much, but they encouraged you to be a part of a program rather than, just having all those things happening, most notably going to jail.
That's right. They asked me if I was aware of insider trading happening on Wall Street, and of course I said it's rampant. And they said that I could help them build these cases against other people. It's going to help me out. I took their card and I said, "Should I talk to a lawyer?" And the FBI actually said, "We'll let you know when you can do that." So they're not supposed to say that. Two people like me killed themselves that summer. I wrote in the book just very tragic situations where people were approached and thought that was it. It was pretty dark for me. I finally told my wife on Friday. She was the only person I could tell, and it wasn't an easy conversation. But as people will see in the book, I'm not the hero of the story. She is, and she took it, as well as she could at the time, saying, "Hey, you didn't do anything to hurt me. If the FBI has given you a chance to clean up the industry, you should do it." 85% of marriages will end, right in that moment or around that moment, when a spouse brings in a federal felony. She just kept saying, "Hey, Tom, you got us into this. You're going to get us out of it somehow." It's really hard for me to pinpoint her resolve to just stick with me through this, because we didn't have children yet, so she could have very easily left or had the marriage absolved, in the church. Many wives would say, "I didn't even know this person. Like, I didn't know you were insider trading. I got married to a good guy." But it wasn't easy. And she was just very stoic about it. We could just focus on things we could control and can't control a lot of things. So for 2 years, the FBI had me running around Wall Street. Some crazy stories, as you mentioned in the book. Every chapter, I'm in a situation where my hands are sweating, my heart's racing. My editor said, "You've written this like 17 times." I'm like, "Well, this is true. Like, how else can I say it? Like, this is exactly it." Trying to get people. Also, people I didn't know that well. So the FBI gave me this open playing field, who are the worst actors. And so anybody listening can imagine, pretend you don't know me that well. You're meeting me at Starbucks. The cover for the meeting is I'm looking for a job. It's 2008. And I'm trying to get you to confess about insider trades you did maybe a few years ago. Of course, people would look at me and think, "Why is this guy asking me all these pointed questions?" I was terrible at it at the start.
Well, that I was really shocked to read that part, which is that you got little to no training as far as I could tell. They were just like, go get information. So like, What did you learn about like doing that?
I had to figure it out, and I didn't really have the context for this until I started writing the book last year, which was years later, watching some FBI hostage negotiation speakers and CIA speakers. And so what the FBI taught me to do eventually when I was fumbling this would say, they'd say, ask a question, Tom, of the target, and then stop and say nothing and have that silence. And so I would just sit there, and it felt like a minute or two would go by because they'd size me up. But there's one chapter called The Three Meeting Dance where I'd meet with the person in person. I'd follow up on the phone call and come back in person. And by the third meeting in person, they would get comfortable enough with me where they would also talk about their sources. I would mirror their language. So I said, oh, yeah, I have my sources too, and sort of mirror the way that they moved around, that like their own body language. And it's harder actually to do this on the phone, of course, because you don't get the body language. But that was kind of how I figured it out. Ask a question, do not say anything. And then the FBI would say, Tom, you're done here, on to the next one. But I really had no idea where this was going. Like, are they really building cases? Until one day in the fall of 2009, when they asked me to turn on the TV.
So, look at this guy's a great storyteller. Everyone wants to know what happened. You turn on the TV, what do you see?
Sure. So Friday morning, my wife just had our first child. She's at home on maternity leave. We're up at 6 a.m. With the baby. FBI says turn on the TV, turn on CNBC. There's 20 guys in handcuffs in the perp walks. Everybody's seen, the FBI windbreaker jackets are out. The news cameras just happen to be there at their apartments or homes when they're being walked out. And all these names are on the screen, people I recognize. There's one name, Dan, that was not released. And they were calling this person like right in the middle of all this. They were calling him Tipper X. And I called the FBI, and I'm an analyst by training, so I can kind of figure out who Tipper X is. And I called the FBI to make sure. Am I Tipper X? He's like, yeah, that's you. And I wasn't sure, how long the Tipper X secret would last. It would only last a few more months until my name was released.
So after it gets released, I mean, you write about like, depression and all kinds of, bad things are happening physically. But what about just the fear of retribution? Like, what was that like living with that?
Yeah, when my name came public, I was scared. These are people who are not happy, I'm sure, that I was, involved with this, who potentially is taking away their freedom, right? They might be looking at prison. I talked to the FBI about that. They said, hey, if you get any threatening calls or confrontations, just to let them know. But it was, I didn't really feel like they were in my corner too much, as people can probably see from the book, that was sort of use Tom until we can't use him anymore, until he hires an attorney, which I didn't for a while. So I was nervous about that. We had moved to New Jersey from the New York City, so we were just sort of starting like a new life with a new baby. And I worried about that. But Sue, my wife, was just so amazing. She said, just focus on being a stay-at-home father the best you can be. Obviously, you can't work right now until you're sentenced. And I went into kind of a shame spiral, as I described. I got very heavy, had trouble carrying my daughter up the stairs, and then went to the doctor. It wasn't great at the doctor. My wife signed me up for a 5K, so I ended up losing 70 pounds, running like crazy. I mentioned ultra marathons in the book, just focusing on my fitness. But I was also not dealing with my professional future, Dan. Like, looking back and writing the book last year and thinking about it, yes, I got the fittest I ever got. But also, whenever Sue wanted to have a conversation about our future, I said I just went for a run. So I was using that as sort of a cushion for not having to deal with my stuff.
And I was going to ask you about your kind of recipe for kind of pulling yourself out of that, and the exercise is a big part of it. But I also just wanted to ask, like, I think about myself. Sometimes I wake up in the middle of the night and I like go, oh shoot, I didn't pay the whatever bill, or like there's something that wakes me up and my mind starts going. But I mean, how did you sleep?
I did not sleep well for years. Part of that was just as a sole sort of stay-at-home parent, just those obligations with young kids, but also the stress. One thing that so and also I mentioned, I went to the self-help aisle and was trying to help myself, and actually focusing on yourself. I wrote, like, turns out it doesn't help you because you're thinking about yourself too much. And so one day again, here comes my wife saying, why don't you go volunteer at the church at night, just help them in their food drives or clothing drives, which we did. So I went to the church and the guy just handed me a clipboard. He didn't say, oh, you're tipper X. He doesn't care, right? He just says, hey, you're an extra pair of hands, come be a service. And for the first time, I started sleeping because I was thinking less about myself. I kind of felt like, all right, I'm going to be a really good volunteer, a really good stay-at-home dad, and maybe someday I'll figure out my professional future. But it was very unclear to me. For entrepreneurs listening, imagine like you've blown up your reputation. Like anybody that Googles you is going to find, this stuff like I had. They're not going to hire, it's even hard to get funding for any idea. My lawyer said, start your own company. I started drop shipping on eBay before it was really a thing. And my suppliers were hijacking my eBay listings. So I was banging my head against the wall. How do I start something with this tainted reputation? And this went on for years until I was finally sentenced in 2015, which was 7 years after that Wendy's meeting with the FBI. So basically all of my 30s were more or less gone at that point.
So when you say you were sentenced, what came after that?
So I was sentenced to no prison because I helped the FBI build ultimately 20 of their 81 cases. And because I did that, the judge said, there's no point sending you to prison. Just you're free to live with your, go on with your life. But I still had a felony conviction, which is a major non-starter for pretty much any company. I was leaving the courtroom, a reporter approached me. She said, this is actually a really interesting story, going from insider trader, losing all the weight, vegan ultra marathoner, stay-at-home dad. This might be just a nice story to have out there and help me like more own the story than somebody else owning it. So she wrote this article. A podcast producer reached out to me of a pretty big podcast 10 years ago, went on that show. And then the FBI was listening somehow to this podcast. An agent called me. And I know the FBI's number is always restricted on my phone, Dan. And I said, my God, what did I do now? It's these guys again. And Sue, my wife, is saying, what did you do? And I don't know. And I answered the phone. They said, Tom, of those 81 guys we arrested, you were the youngest, Tom. And the $46,000 was the lowest amount of money. And I said, well, thanks for rubbing it in. I was actually trying not to get caught. And they said, well, that was a really interesting story. Why do highly educated, otherwise good people go down this path? Why don't you come speak to the FBI? I spoke to the FBI and they said, hey, you know what your calling should be is going to make lemonade out of lemons. Go around, share this story as a cautionary tale with the financial services industry at that time. And I didn't think about any sort of professional opportunity from this. It was more of a pilgrimage. I mentioned just going to colleges, speaking for free, trying to get my reps in. My wife took another job. She had been working at in the real estate market in Lehman Brothers before that, and she was holding down the fort. And I remember one day I got paid $3,000 for one talk. And my wife was struggling with this new job, and I could see she just wasn't into it anymore. And I said, don't worry, I've got this. You don't have to work anymore. And she says, you're crazy. You've made $3,000. And I think, Dan, like my ultimate moment of being accountable for this was just when my family, my back was up against the wall. I now have to step up and provide. My wife shouldn't have to go through this anymore. That was just the lit the fire in me to say, okay, I will now be starting a speaking business. This is my entrepreneurial journey going to try to speak with this tattered past.
So, I think it's amazing, and I've heard you talk about the talks that you give at colleges, trying to get us all or listeners to kind of like stop for a second and think about some of the decisions that we're making, these micro decisions that could add up to something bad. But I'm wondering, is there part of you that is like, you know what, I just want to move on from this. I don't want to remind people what I did. I want to just like start over. Was that a struggle with writing this book or and doing the speaking?
It is, and it's a great question. I do wonder, the book was so much more detailed than my usual kind of 45-minute keynote, and going into this, and now it's going to be out in the world, in this year in 2026. But I can tell you, it just feels like a calling. Like every time I give a talk, especially not to now the next generation, which I'm, approaching, my late 40s now, and so there's a whole new crop of people on Wall Street or in any industry working. Whenever I can talk to them. And they just come up to me and say, I'll never forget this because you kind of seem like me, a regular guy that, got in a situation over his head. That keeps me going. It's sort of, I feel just like it's my calling, to keep sharing this story. Also, it's a balance of it's a cautionary tale, but I also think in with the book, it's sort of a redemption story too, just owning, accepting responsibility for a major public failure and trying to make sense of it.
You've told your story a lot in talks, and you've written it now, and I wonder, like, when you're talking to me about it, you're recounting it. Are you like, do your palms still get sweaty when you talk about it, or is it almost like you're like telling somebody about a movie that you saw but you happen to be in? Like, are you able to disconnect from it as you've told it over and over again?
Kind of in the post-COVID years, I've been able to disconnect. So it's a great question. For my corporate talks or the conference keynote, I take a minute before to put myself back in that headspace, so I can actually feel my palms sweating and my heart racing on stage. So I definitely want to bring that energy for all of my engagements. But I'm in a good place now, where once I step off the stage, I'm back to being Tom, right? Not being Tipper X on the stage. So I've been able to compartmentalize that, to deliver, what the client wants, the impact that I want to deliver. But also, I'm not losing sleep anymore, as we were talking about earlier at night,
Is
about
there
this.
I know you give a talk, but is there kind of one thing that you tell people that you see kind of eyes open or heads tilt, or that you feel like makes an impact with people when you're talking about what you've been through and how you kind of got yourself out of it?
People will, here's one thing actually in the book. People will, when I started speaking years ago, said, "Oh, Tom, you made some mistakes and paid for it." And that made me feel better about it, because the word mistake made me feel better. And when you think about it, I actually made bad decisions. And anybody listening, if we call our bad decisions mistakes, we're not really owning those decisions. It actually makes us feel better about them. So it's important to look at our lives, I think, and we all make mistakes, we all make bad decisions. But to understand the difference between the two, mistakes are something that, was an accident, and bad decisions were with some kind of intent. So that's been an eye opener for me, even with my children now, who are teenagers. You can imagine all the mistakes and bad decisions that they're looking at potentially. And so for me, as now as their father, being able to sort of course correct. So that's a big kind of eye opener that I've seen, that was sort of a process over the years of getting to that insight. And really, as I go on this journey, like, anybody's scars can become their service. So that's something I espouse with people too. Just your worst moments can actually be of help for somebody else, if you're willing to lean into that
That's
and
great.
share it.
Is there any kind of daily habit that that you recommend, something that's kind of helped you?
So one thing I do is I have a rationalization journal going through this experience. And anytime I'm thinking about a big decision, now that might be for my kids or family or for my speaking business, do I want to go in this direction or that? And I start telling myself stories as to why that would be a good decision. I write down those rationalizations and I reflect on them pretty often, just to see what to get the self-talk, out of my head onto paper. So that's something important I do pretty much every day or every other day.
And I'm a big fan of mob movies and stuff like that, and I'm wondering, is there one that stands out to you as saying, like, they really nailed it with the FBI and the informant relationship? And is there anything that you've watched where you're like, that is not how that happens?
Yeah, so the Departed was a good one, and another good one, it's escaping me, but the name of the man who, if you remember the Atlanta Olympics, the 1996, there was a
Oh,
bombing,
Richard
and
Jewell.
Richard Jewell, there was a movie about him, where the FBI tried to frame him, and the way that they approached him was almost exactly how they approached me. They said, "Richard, we can help you out. Don't talk to a lawyer. He's a young guy, a security guy, I think, that they were trying to frame for the bombing at the Olympics." So that was actually very well written. Other stories, I don't know, like Wolf of Wall Street wasn't my experience. I mean, that's a good story, it's a different story. But those are two. And Wall Street, we started off talking about that. It's so dated now, but that Blue Horseshoe, Loves Anna Scott Steele, was kind of how the tip I got in Away from the Woman. So it was very, very familiar.
That's wild. Well, the book, as people are listening to that, I think it is hitting the shelves today. It's called Wired on Wall Street. And how can people kind of, besides the book, how can they kind of keep up with what you're up to, what you're talking about?
Sure. Feel free to reach out to me. The website's tipperx.com. I actually just learned from the U.S. Patent Office that I have the trademark on TipperX. So I'm the only TipperX out there on the internet. So I'm tipperx.com. So the next FBI case, they have to skip the tip of Y.
Wow. Now, has Elon Musk reached out to you about that? Does he want to buy?
No, so yeah, that's a good idea. Maybe I can exit my speaking business through a deal with Elon. X looks different.
At least get a ride to Mars or something. You know, get something out of it. Yeah,
that's a good point. And I'm most active on LinkedIn. So if people are on LinkedIn, I'm always sharing my thoughts on this behavioral risk and rationalizations and all these cases that we see pretty much every week. You know, there's something out
Excellent.
There.
Excellent. All right, Tom, thanks so much. Really appreciate your time.
Thanks. It was a pleasure.